Okay, and as Mark put it, we fully appreciate this is the first time a lot of you have heard this, and your brain's probably about to explode. So we'll get feedback from you after the session, and that'll help inform how we need to follow this up, what we could do better, what we could do differently, etc. Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew Lyons from Goldman Sachs. Mark, maybe a question for you. Just looking at transaction banking more holistically, your revenue return on risk-weighted assets over the past decade have basically doubled over a period in which we've basically done a full round trip on rates, so you can't put it back to rates. I guess the question, there's two questions. I guess part of this improvement appears to have been the mix of the business, which has shifted far more towards PCM away from trade. But can you maybe just talk about how PCM returns have actually developed over that period, particularly as you've built out this platform services business? What do the returns of that part of the business look like? And then I guess a second question, just in relation to the extent that you've had a lot of success in the PCM business, will that require you ultimately to offer more trade to your customers going forward, and maybe see that mix shift a little bit back towards trade?
Yep. The heart of the, and you can jump in on this too, Lisa. The heart of the PCM business is that it's really integrated into the customer activity. It's effectively we're managing their working capital for them, if you want to put it in really simple terms. Whatever their payments that they're making, the cash that they're collecting from their customers, the way that they're driving new growth in their business effectively flows through to us, which allows us to do, to ingest the payments and then make the payments, but store the value. I think what's the term you used?
Capture and fulfillment.
Fulfillment and store and fulfill. And so there's a number of benefits that come to flow through to us on that. First of all, the first really important one is you're integrated with the customer, which means you can, as they grow, we see more volumes, a multiplier effect for our business, which is why we've shown those graphs of the number of transactions, etc., that you see. So really important to the customer, and they rely heavily on us. And as they're more successful, we're more successful, which is why we focus really heavily on high-quality customers that really have those high volumes. And so when you look at what happens through interest rate, so where we make the money is obviously in fees. It's in the operational balances. Is it in other deposits they give us through moving the cash into TDs and other and back? So there's lots of flow that occurs. And so as rates rise, obviously we'll make more money on that. But as rates will shift, we've really managed margin management or enhanced our margin management around that significantly over the period. So for me, and then the other thing, the final thing I'd make here is that we've focused pretty heavily on customers that have this need, both domestic and internationally and multi-jurisdictional. And this is where the network becomes really important. We don't just do this for customers in Australia or New Zealand. We're doing it in multiple geographies and increasingly across several of those geographies and integrated, which again creates us in a sustainable position and allows us to get not only benefits from US dollar rate movements, but also Australian rate movements, Kiwi rate movements in some local markets as well. So there's a real multiplier effect on it, Andrew. And so the upside for us, I think, going forward is still significant. Even though we've got large market positions, I think, in the domestic markets, we think there's significant growth offshore, and this multiplier effect, don't underestimate it. As customers grow and do more with GDP, we're not only doing that directly with our own internal systems, directly with our customers, but we're doing it with other customers' customers. That's what the agency business is. That's what client money is. Client monies is all about. And we'll need to talk to those particular things with you more so you understand it more deeply. But we're basically banking our customers' customers, even though they're not directly with us. Our main customer is, but their customers, which could be 416,000 accounts, I think is the number, means you get this multiplier effect. So this has been a deliberate strategy. It hasn't happened by chance. We knew that if you looked at where our returns were in 2016, high emphasis, 45% of our revenue from lending, low return. We had this asset that we wanted to build on, and we put all of the major part of our investment into this part of the business because, one, it integrates your customers, makes them sticky. Anyone can lend money. People can't replicate this capability very quickly, but you get multiplier effects in volume, which actually helps us with margins as rates move up and down, and also the multi-jurisdictional piece of it means you get multiplier effects. So hopefully that helps. I can't remember the second part of the question.
I can maybe answer the second part if that's okay, Mark. So I think there's a couple of things to think about. First of all, our franchise has grown. So if I look back to where we were probably 2015, 2016 in terms of where PCM, the number of customers we now have that have ANZ as their primary transaction banker has increased significantly, particularly across our home markets and throughout the region. So the size of our customer base has grown. Secondly, it, as Mark said, it's our agency or our platforms business that has continued to grow. We have, through our risk governance, through our technology frameworks, been able to capitalise on changes in the market and acquire significant market share, particularly over the last 4 years, which has seen both our correspondent banking business and our agency business have double-digit growth. And we continue to see a lot of that growth continue as they start to evolve more of their business model. So I think that's a really important piece. So the mix within TB has, in transaction banking, has changed. We, on the trade side as well, we have also changed the composition of our trade book from traditional trade loans and focused more on the supply chain finance. Why is that important? It comes back to actually the PCM part, which is a lot of our customers' data is so critical to the way that they manage their businesses and what we call that kind of real-time economy and also counterparty risk. So it's really about growing our PCM business as a share of the whole transaction banking business. And then it's also repositioning our trade business to parts of it that we know is where our customers are going, such as supply chain finance, which also do generate higher returns as well.
Philip.
Hey, thanks for the opportunity. I know you've mentioned a few customer names today, but can you just specifically run us through a list of a few customer wins that has been that's taken place over the last, you know, maybe couple of years as a result of the increased capability?
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got to be careful because we've got to get permission from all of our customers, but maybe I can talk a bit about by sector. So in the client money space, there's been specific stock brokers that we have worked with. We are now providing the core cash management account that sits on their platform. So if you go across the market, you can probably see who have been some of the winners in that space, and underlying that is an ANZ account that supports their customers with their broking activity. So that's probably one of the big areas that we've seen a lot of growth with. And the core customer base, COVID was actually really challenging in terms of most customers did not want to move their transaction banking during a period of what I'll call continuous BCP. However, we did have some key customers. Lendlease, who we actually recently had present to our board, was probably one of the biggest mandates here locally that we've had transition across to ANZ. And again, one of probably the largest customers on the ASX 200 and also very complex in terms of their transaction banking requirements. We've also had more recent wins, and again, these are really looking at multinationals. You're looking at FIG customers as well, particularly some of the insurers. And again, in the correspondent banking business, a number of the banks. So our key areas of focus remain in the financial institutions, also non-bank financial institutions, where we're seeing above system growth. But we're continuing to see growth in our core corporate and institutional franchise. And I suggest when after this session, there's a booth in there called the NPP, or the Real-Time Payments Pay To. Really simply, what we see this as probably being ANZ's opportunity to really leverage and continue to grow our market, as we see this the next buying decision, particularly for customers here locally. What is it really simply? It helps our customers at the top end of the market be able to collect payments using the real-time payments network. It is not regulatory-driven. It is voluntary investment that ANZ has decided to make to support our customers as they transition from traditional payment methods into real-time payment methods. And we see that really as being probably the next area where we're going to see some positive competition in the market.
We have some big government mandates which are public as well, being obviously New South Wales, the biggest bank transaction banking business in the country, and also more recently South Australian government. So it's across different sectors, and we are a bit cautious about mentioning the name simply because we have to first get permission that we're going to say that, obviously.
Yep. I might go to this side of the room just briefly. So, Ed.
Thank you. Can you touch a little bit more on competition, both domestically and internationally? Your domestic peers have obviously spent a lot of money on retail banking and SME banking. You know, are they coming back? You know, where are they at the moment on the institutional side? And also, you talked about the really high returns, especially on the payment side. You know, are you worried about a rogue player coming in and pricing really cheaply? And can you just run through that, please?
Yeah, can I start, and then Lisa again, you and Lee maybe can also. The first thing I'd say about what we've built, and this is why I emphasise the digital backbone a bit, because put simply, all that is that we're deploying one system that handles a certain product, if I've got loans or trade or markets, which we've traditionally built internally and use some vendors, but one system that goes to every part of the business that we operate in, so every country, if you think about it that way. Effectively, that's the vertebrae, if you like. And then within the spine is that we've linked that through a single customer identifier, which allows us then to connect all of that from a data perspective, which means we can service the customer better. They get similar service regardless of where they deal with us. But we also get clean data for regulators and others, so it makes us more efficient, risk management particularly. And in an area of operational risk and cyber, and all, this is really important. So that's quite important. We've done that for the network, and we'll finish that soon, as I've suggested. But there's a lot of that quality system and integration that we can take deeper into the group. So, for example, with what we're doing, you're hearing the other banks are moving ahead, investing in their business banking space. We're talking with Claire now internally around what we can take down into her world to utilise what we've already built, whether it's in PCM, whether it's in trade, loans, financial markets particularly, how we can integrate and take that down rather than build new stuff there. And I think that's a real value for us proposition going forward, not just for obviously volume going through our channels, but also obviously allowing us a better proposition, if you like, to market for that segment. But did you want to add?
Absolutely. And maybe come back to the question on competition. So I think each of the banks have obviously focused their attention on different parts of the market. ANZ's always had a very strong institutional franchise. We started off as a trade bank. So for us, it's very much in our DNA. And I know Shane talks about that. Having a strong trade bank means generally you have a strong corresponding bank, recognising the cross-border element. And then for us, it's logically that you have a strong payments and cash management bank. So we have been very specific with Mark's sponsorship about directing capital and investment into those three lines of business, recognising they form part of our customers' working capital. It's where you have the highest engagement with your customers to understand the needs within their business, and also you can actually then strengthen and broaden out the full capability across the institutional space. So for us, this is about a full service proposition, of which the working capital elements, PCM, correspondent banking and trade really form that anchor point of having those conversations. And particularly in a really data-rich world, our customers are expecting us to provide insights to help them manage and provide prompts in their business today. So in terms of competition, we will always see competition. I take competition is actually a good thing. It keeps the bar constantly being moved. And, you know, from a perspective is we don't see a lot in terms of our domestic peers, but they will always try and support their customers that are important to their franchise. So I think that is going to be a continuum. And I think that's a very healthy environment to be on. In terms of new players coming to the market, we've seen fintechs come into the market for a long time. And I would like to be kind of very quite clear is we are a banker to fintechs as much as we see them as competition in certain spaces. And again, what they are bringing in is innovation into the marketplace, which we know from an industry and also from a regulatory perspective, I think makes for a healthy ecosystem for our market. So for us, we see that as actually complementary to what we're doing as a PCM business. In terms of the price play, which I think where your question was going, Phil, you're always, and we've always seen, whether it's direct banking peers come in with a specific price play or we're going to see with monoline price coming with a price play. What we do know is a lot of our customers don't want to have multi-vendor relationships. It adds complexity into their business, whether that's through technology integration, whether it's through contractual obligations, whether it's through vendor management. What they would prefer to do is provide full service capability from a single provider, on the assumption that that full service provider continues to innovate and keep the product set contemporary to support their business. Yep. Lee, I don't know if you want to add.
Just a couple of things. Sorry. So on the, thanks Mark, the transaction banking platform, you know, that's a market leading platform now for us in Australia and New Zealand and increasingly the globe. It's a lot easier for us to take that platform down and leverage a single asset into our commercial customer base as opposed to taking a retail platform and bringing it up, especially because of the complexity that we have with our customers and increasingly with regards to the product set that they use. So we're looking to leverage that down into our commercial segment. On the competition side, you know, it's, you know, we speak to a lot of fintechs who are trying to or maybe attempt to directly join these networks. And after they realise some of the complexity and the time and the cost that it takes to get direct access to these networks, the conversation quickly changes into how can we, you know, be part of the capability that you've built. And so I think that that's a real strong play for us, and it's one of those things that I think that will continue to grow as we move forward.
Gosh, so many.
You talked, obviously, domestic players aren't doing a lot. Fintechs you're kind of trying to integrate with. But what about the offshore players? Mm. You know, are you worried about someone that might come in and play there?
Can I answer that question? Because I think the proof point, I've been thinking about that because I wondered whether that was part of your question.
I wanted to go.
Oh, okay. All right. I'll jump in there. But I think the proof point that, you know, we already service the domestic payment needs of the major international banks really shows you that they've made decisions for their network countries and network customers that going with a high-quality domestic player like ANZ for their domestic payments servicing is the right strategic choice. So I think we've got the evidence because we bank them, we facilitate their payments, we connect with integration services, as Lee mentioned, and that's their strategy, and they're very happy with it, and they're very long-term relationships.
Yeah. The other thing just on that too is that with the international competitor, I know we're going to get them all, don't worry, even if we have to jump break into some coffee time. The other with the international customers, we're very careful of selecting. That's why I've concentrated. Remember, we've got 6,300. We'll build on that now, but we were 27,000. We were spreading. We're trying to do everything to everybody, and we were leading with lending. Yeah. So we were competing with Citibank and others in countries that we were just never going to, we were getting hammered. And so we had the wrong proposition. And to the point that Lisa made around, we are a trade bank, but we were not leading with the payments, cash management and trade integration to get the back, and that's where the value was. We're actually just trying to compete on lending. So we flipped that. And what that's meant is we've chosen customers specifically that want an Australian New Zealand piece, yeah, and or both, and also are keen to be banking with us in Asia particularly, because we're not really offering transaction banking in the US, right? So in Asia particularly, where we're operating in a number of countries where and compete very well with the likes of Citibank, Standard Chartered. So our product capability is very good, but we're selecting customers who want that both Australia and New Zealand leg, as well as the multi-jurisdictions in Asia, with what we can develop. And I think that's flipped the profile. So we do compete with them. Sometimes we lose. But a lot of the time we win, and we've got a number of major companies, like we haven't got permission to talk about those names, that operate with us in multiple, like 12, 15 jurisdictions, either in trade and supply chain, but also in PCM. So it's, you know, it's not an easy market, but I think our proposition is pretty good and it's targeted. That's the big difference.
Brendan.
Good morning, Brendan Sprouse from Citi. I've just got a couple of questions just on the mix of your current business at the moment. Mm-hmm. I think it's on slide 17, you show the deposit balances, which obviously actually fell a little bit during the last half. And you show there that the operational deposits around two-thirds. To what extent in this business are you going to get migration out of operational deposits into higher rate term deposits? We're familiar with this concept in retail. And then I have a second question.
Yep, you can jump into on this one too, yep. Lisa. But look, we get that all the time. As rates move up or as customers, you know, operations and what they're doing themselves might be slowing or whatever, and then they've got excess cash, they'll maybe move it into TD. So you see that movement all the time. We do manage the margins in TDs as much as what we try and do with the operational accounts. So you'll see that shift move up and down based on individual customer requirements, but also what's happening in the general economy. And you are seeing a little bit more active management of that as rates have gone higher, as you would expect from customers. But it does move around. Did you want to add more time?
And I think the critical thing here is the classification of the deposit. So we generally support and provide a premium to our customers because they are operational deposits, because we have the payments, both the receivables and the collections, to get that right categorisation. So customers will generally move things into term deposits when they've either got counterparty risks or they've got particular treasury policies that they need to do that. But we often find a lot of customers do not want to have to actively manage that portfolio because that's there to support the day-to-day working capital of the business. So you generally find it's not as rate sensitive as what we'll call wholesale funds, which generally does go into the market to seek higher return. That's why you'll see it remains relatively stable, and it's more about our customer acquisition. So are we bringing on more customers who are bringing more operational deposits, both on the direct PCM business and also the platforms business, is really where you're going to see the movement in that operational balance, because it is, once it moves into a term deposit, the classification changes and it becomes a wholesale deposit.
And
And just my second question, which is on slide 20, you show us the split of PCM revenue into primary propositions and platform services.
Yep.
Now, you've had a big pickup in the activity in platform services. Mm. How big is that mix, or how's that mix going to change as we look out sort of over the, into the medium term?
So where, maybe let me start where it's probably come from, and then we can think about where it's come to. So where it's come from is, if I probably go back 3 years, that was probably half of where it is today in terms of comprising about 21% by proposition. That was probably just over kind of 10%+. So we anticipate this will continue to grow higher than system growth, recognising that intermediaries and different parties are taking a larger part of the market share in certain propositions. So our growth will be pegged off the back of that, of their growth.
Cool. Thank you.
Morty.
Two questions, if I could. The first one, there's some good buzzwords. full service proposition, digital backbone, all that stuff.
Yep.
When you pitch for a new business, usually Lendlease or any of the others that you've been talking about winning, do you actually go through, it's competitive, you know, state government's extremely competitive. Do you look at it at a product level, even though you're providing what's the return on each individual product, or do they look at it at a customer wide? So, yes, we're losing on this product, but we're making on another product. How do you price to win that transaction? And then secondly, just another one, especially when you're doing financial institution transactions for another bank or a stockbroking firm or whatever it is, how do you manage KYC and AML?
Yep.
Because even though it mightn't be your customer, it looks really bad if it goes through your platform and you're executing a lot of money laundering for a third party.
It's really, that last piece is really important.
Absolutely.
So you guys go for this one.
So maybe I'll start with the last question first. And this is where the strength of our correspondent banking business has served us very well in terms of really understanding what we call enhanced customer due diligence. And then being also operating in 29 markets and facing off against multiple regulators gives us a really good line of sight around not only where the market is today in terms of expectations around KYC, but where it is going. So we work very closely with both our internal teams in terms of our financial crime risk, our compliance teams, but also with the regulators, be recognising this is a growing area that we take very seriously around what we call the operating risk associated with this space. So we are disproportionately investing our capability in terms of compliance, in terms of our financial crime teams, and particularly in terms of the enhanced due diligence, the transaction monitoring that Lee referred to a little bit earlier. And that is a continuing area that we'll continue to focus on. In terms of the RFP element, PCM is highly competitive. Banks know the value when you go through and you are doing a syndicated lending facility. Our customers know that the PCM is the cream on the cake, and that they want to give it to what they deem as their primary banking provider, recognising the returns. So our customers are quite aware of the value of the business, and they will look to leverage that. But what they are fundamentally looking for is capability and commitment to ongoing investment. I referred back to the average tenor being over 10 years. Customers don't like to move their PCM. It is not easily transportable. It takes a lot of technology integration effort. It takes a lot of business process engagement. So that's why if you are able to make sure that you can retain the customer and the franchise through that continual investment in capability and grow, because you've got a clear part of differentiation, that's where you can actually generally build out the franchise and create that differentiated proposition.
So does that mean sometimes, you've seen in retail banking for years, you provide a great discount in the first year, then the longer you keep them, you make more money out of the customer, and you're prepared to price very aggressively to win the transaction, win the customer, knowing that it's longevity where you make your returns. Is that how you think about it?
Sometimes, again, each customer proposition will be different, so it'll be different. Some customers are much more fee sensitive, some are interest rate sensitive, some are very much capability and what I call transition risk, which is why Lee's area, particularly in terms of the integration and translation capabilities, are so critical. A lot of our customers operate on legacy infrastructure. The hardest thing for them is not about the demand side for new capability, it's actually how do they allow their systems to allow them to access new capabilities such as real-time payments. So the services we can provide around helping them with that digital transformation is really critical for keeping contemporary capability in their hands and for their business. So no two customers are the same. Price always is critical. After you go through that list of requirements in terms of a commitment to the business in terms of ongoing innovation, data thought leadership, product capability, transition and implementation services, It always, there'll be a discussion around price.
The capability piece, the price always comes into it, Jonathan, but the capability piece is really important. This we're talking about the cash management and transactional, you know, how they run their blood in their veins. Yep. So we have to be able to demonstrate we've got the capability today to do that well, and whether we can do it across jurisdictional. That's why the customer selection piece is really important for us, and the ongoing investment, whether it's in cyber or whether it's in just product capability, very, very important for us to do that and having ongoing investment. But then the innovation piece also has to be at the front. So we've won a lot of transaction banking mandates of recent years based on our data insights, because we put effort into that. So we could tell customers what they were seeing in each individual stores, for example, around different sales and some of the reasons why, the demographics of the people going into the stores. So there's a lot of value-added benefit that we try and bring into that whole bidding process, which wouldn't be visible to you, but that the data and insights is critical. As we get digital backbone, I know it's a term that, you know, I like it, a lot of people don't, but anyway, I like it. You can visualise it, right? The benefit of that is that data is going to be clean, first time ever. Right, because we don't have multiple systems that aren't integrated. We're going to have single-use systems that are integrated. Cleaner data, much better insights is a key capability piece for customers going forward. And then you've got the other innovation, which is the stuff, while we sort of, you know, sprinkled some, you know, what we're doing in digital assets and digital currencies, because that's going to be the next level of innovation. Our systems have to be in a position where we're positioned for that when it comes. We're not going to make a lot of money on it today, but it's going to be important to customers in due course, and that's why, you know, what we're doing in Nigel's team there is important.
I just had a couple of points, if I may. The transition is hard, right? Customer transition is hard, right? The reason we're market leading is because we've invested a lot of money to make it easy, right? So that if somebody's banking somewhere else, they can come across to us with a minimum of fuss and change to their own existing systems. I think that's one of the secret sauce elements around our success in that. The AML KYC, I mean, the client monies platform, one of the hardest integration parts of building that platform is the integration upstream for payments out screening and then accounts in screening, right? So it's tightly integrated up and down the stack. It's one of the challenges of building one of those systems. And the data insights that Mark mentioned, you'll see some of that out in the booths later on.
We agonise that KYC is a really important question. I'm glad you asked it, because I was hoping we'd get it. It is really important. I worry less about credit today than I've ever worried, only because I think the quality of the customer base keeps us relatively safe. You can't rely on it completely. And where our risk management processes and focus and culture is a lot different than what it was in 2016. I worry more about this, because that's the area that you need to have right. So we're uncomfortable about that all the time, and that's a good thing, because this is really important business for us. It's important to our customers as well, but very important to the regulators. So we agonise over this.
Could you pass it to Triggsy? Thanks.
Thanks, Jill. Andrew Triggs from JP Morgan. I just wondered if you had any data, or if you give it a sense of what the Asia Pac system is growing at in terms of the fee pool for payments and platforms. And has ANZ growth been demonstrably strong with that, bearing out some of the advantages that you talked to today? And then just second point, maybe around that KYC AML piece, a lot's been made of Westpac pulling out of the correspondent banking business. Just interested to hear your thoughts on just how substantive a benefit that has been, or if that is sort of been a bit overemphasised.
Maybe can you just read on the question, which angle are you looking at in terms of the exit? Is overemphasised in terms of...
In terms of the revenue benefit to ANZ from, you know, major domestic player exiting the fold?
Yep.
You can maybe mention how many customers we picked up, I think.
Yeah, so I think correspondent banking requires significant investment, and we've seen that pre the exit of one of our peer banks in that. And if you look at some of the FI metrics statistics, and FI metrics is the global survey for correspondent banking, what we saw predating that was that there was a decline in a number of the other banks in terms of their market share. We were continuing to grow our market share, and again, that's about that investment and innovation capability that is required for our financial institutions. So that really was provided kind of an accelerant to a trend that we were already seeing across the business, and we were very clear around our customer selection when that event did occur around which customers were within our risk appetite, recognising back to the questions that we had earlier around the operational risk, and we'd already had conversations about our pipeline opportunities with those. So we will continue to look to see where we can grow our correspondent banking at 60% market penetration. You're kind of at that top point, but there is continued cross-sell, which is why the agency is so important, because it's not just about the foreign, what we call the first leg into the country, but it's actually the domestic clearing that hangs off the back of it. So we see those two very much hand in hand, and our agency proposition has served us very well in continuing to get the mandates on the correspondent banking side. So it was an accelerant probably to the existing growth that was already there, but I wouldn't say in and of itself it was the reason for that growth.
We also said no to a number of customers based on that customer selection piece that I talked about, and we want to be very careful about who we bank, not just lend money to, but who we bank in this space. So there's a number that we said that came up. We chose which ones we wanted, went after them and got majority of them, but we said no to a number as well.
Yep.
It's a discipline that we have to have in the business, in this business particularly.
And then just the second part of the first part of the question, which is really on the international franchise. So we've seen quite a lot of growth in our client monies, or what we call our virtual accounts, particularly around with a lot of the leasing companies throughout the Asia Pacific region, similarly into the insurance. Again, our strength is really around the non-bank financial FIs, and then also with some of the larger corporates. So it isn't the same market penetration, obviously, as what we have in our home markets, but we're seeing the benefits, particularly with Nigel's connectivity around the real-time payment systems in various jurisdictions, about how we can stitch those together on behalf of our customers, and importantly, providing liquidity solutions, which we know is really important across the region, where there is, you know, challenges around leveraging liquidity based on local regulations and customer proposition. So we're very selective where we play in Asia based on our capability and obviously the customer selection process.
I guess the question was, can you give us a sense of what the total market's growing at? Is it a low single digit, mid single digit fee pool growth type market within the Asia Pac region?
Or for ANZ or for the general market?
For the general system.
For the general system, Asia still continues to grow quite strongly. Part of that has been obviously the real shift to real-time payments. If you look at the key markets of India, Singapore, Hong Kong, you've seen really accelerated growth in China into that same bucket as well. Is we're seeing that transformation now of payments being microtized in terms of, you know, it might have been one payment for X dollars, you're now seeing customers making multiple payments, recognizing that same because they can with the real-time payments, also thinking about liquidity. So we've got a general trend that's seeing the volume of payments increase, and this is why scale and resiliency is so important for many of our customers, and why they do look to a AA rated bank with payments credentials, because of the importance to be able to support that payment growth.
Whereas lending over there has dropped 30% in the last 12 months.
By us or generally?
No, generally. So that whole market's dropped in. People have just, and that's why you're seeing a bit of growth in the lending markets here and tenor growth, because a lot of the Asian banks are looking for where they can go to get assets. This business continues to grow, and that's why another reason why we like it.
So we're going to go to Richard, then John, and then we'll go back over here. Sorry, Azib. I'm not deliberately ignoring you.
Good morning, Richard Wiles, Morgan Stanley. Mark, in your results presentations, you disclose that the long run loss rate in the institutional business is now expected to be 19 basis points. Mm. Commercial's expected to be 53. So you're suggesting that institutional is less than half as risky as commercial.
I'm not suggesting that, but it was
the group is the group suggesting it.
Yeah.
So it leads me to a few questions around your credit risk profile. Mm-hmm. Firstly, is you think institutional's lower risk than commercial across the cycle. Which do you think is more volatile? You know, you think institutional will be less volatile than commercial if we have a downturn? Secondly, how do you think your 19 basis points for institutional loss rates compares with your domestic peers? Do you think your institutional bank is a lower risk institutional bank than theirs? Mm-hmm. Thirdly,
yeah, I'll never remember all these.
Can you I'll repeat them all for you if you want.
You're writing them down. Good.
Thirdly, is Australian New Zealand loss rates similar to Asia, or do you think one's higher than the other? Mm-hmm. And then finally, if 19 basis points is the average loss rate for institutional and 50 plus is for commercial, and your commercial business is way smaller than CBA and NAB, do you guys think that your credit risk profile is do you think you're a lower risk credit risk bank than the other three major banks in Australia?
I think the mix is, well, and it goes through cycles, as you know, Richard. I mean, you know, and, you know, I think you're seeing some pressure coming through in that sort of middle market space now, finally, you know, particularly in the construction area and you know, smaller aged care facilities and areas like that. So to, there's a bit of truth in that. We've been very, so let me just start with the us and commercial. We do have a lower expected loss, and that's been a deliberate strategy because we wanted to bank. We had 27,000 customers in institutional in 2017. We didn't know 20,000 of them. We didn't. We were just lending money. And so we've reduced it down to customers that we know, but really importantly, high-quality investment-grade customers who we think are of good character. There's some that we felt we didn't want to bank, even in certain industries where they were highly rated, but we just didn't like the nature of the business, so we said no to them. And so we've been really quite focused on the people that we feel want our services, but also we can trust in doing business. And I think that's been a big part of the reduction that you've seen in the expected loss rates.
And just
doesn't mean
lending.
Yeah, and a lot of it was, and the second thing was it was lending, right? We were doing a lot of lending. So we've reduced that. Now, risk-weighted assets are going back up again, but they're only on the basis because we're starting to grow the business again, and we're still doing high volumes of DCM and loan syndications and getting part of that. So the strategy for us was to deal with less people, but of higher quality, lend them less, get a better mix of business, which was more capital light, and therefore we've seen that reduction. And it won't mean that we won't have losses because we, you know, there'll be something that occurs, but I think the frequency of those losses will be lower, and I think the size of them should be lower. That would be what we're aspiring to, if I can put it that way. But our ROE still we're at 14%. And we want to we want to maintain that in those teens, if you like. I want to continue to see it grow. But if you look at the ROE of the commercial business, it's much higher than that. So even if you've got higher expected losses in that business, I'd take it every day of the week, and I'd certainly take it in small business because they're very profitable businesses. Much higher return on equity than you necessarily get in institutional. So our game is to be consistent and get the returns going to a quality level for a long, sustainable period. You're going to get some volatility, I think, in losses potentially in commercial and small business because banks talk about that differently. But to my mind, there's still areas that you want to invest in because they're very high return on equity. You can take higher losses. You know, I love the small business banking. I think we should be going hard
at that. And most of what we do in small business is liabilities. They've got 2.5 times the liabilities to assets. So
and lending. So I think those franchises are still highly valuable, whether it's with us or with other banks, is my personal view. What was the other?
So do you think you're less risky than peers?
Do I think on our Insto business, less risky? Oh, I wouldn't say the peers tend to be more focused in Australia and New Zealand and less in Asia. And they're actually doing some stuff. I'm seeing some growth in some of the peers in investing in assets in the US and Canada. We do a little bit of that. We're quite selective about how much weight we put into those assets. If we don't know the customers well, we don't tend to lend. I would say our customer base is exceptionally good. If we were able to share with you all the names that we're dealing with, this is a cream of customers globally that we're dealing with. Deliberate strategy and deliberate propositions to maintain relevance to them. I actually think it stacks up exceptionally well, even when you compare it to just the top domestic companies, if I can put it that way. So I think we're in good shape.
So there's this long-held perception that you're a lower return and higher risk bank.
Not anymore.
The comment you just made on business banking versus Insto would suggest that because you're underweight in that space and overweight in Insto, you're still lower return, but are you actually lower risk?
I don't think we're anywhere near the risk that we were previously. And I think from an institutional perspective, our risk is you know, at par with the others, if not better, with some of the quality of the names that we have, and with the growth opportunities we have with the mix of business. So I think the share price gets weighed down because we are higher institutional. That's been the premise for a long time. I think that was relevant, very relevant in 2016, because we were underperforming. You know, we're always at the, if there was a credit loss, we were usually at the front of the queue. You know, that was the reality of it. We've worked hard to be at the back of the queue first, and that gets to the quality of the customer. I know I've said it a lot of time, but it's really true. But it also is to the mix of the business that you're providing and what you're providing in the way of capital and lending, et cetera. And we've reduced that significantly, and we monitor that really closely. So I think the value of the institutional business is probably undervalued, but you know, you guys will be determined of that eventually. But I do think it's the main point. It's a much different business than what it was in 2016. A much different business.
I do need to keep this moving along. So, but John, I'm conscious you had your hand up for a while, and then I'll just double check that there's nothing left over this side.
Thanks, Jill. Mike, I wanted to just ask you about the international business. Slide 41, right at the back of your pack. Appreciate, obviously, you've done a great job in terms of how you've grown PCM, and I think that's reflected in the deposit franchise.
Yep.
You've obviously had a big kick in the returns from international, gone from 30 basis points to 170 during a period of time where US dollar interest rates have obviously moved up quite sharply. I'm just kind of cognizant and conscious of the fact that we are going into a different rate cycle now, and maybe just get your input on how rate sensitive the international business is and what's the impact if rates go down on the international profitability.
Yeah, look, if rates go down, there'll be some impact on a revenue sense. I wouldn't necessarily say that translates to what we call returns. We're focused, international was very focused on revenue in 2016, which meant we were lending money predominantly to anybody. Right? And we had a very high cost base in the international market, right? Because every geography was running to its own drum. Well, double counting revenue, but single counting expenses, so they thought they could drive expenses up. That was the reality of what we were dealing with. What we've done is we have deployed a different type of proposition to the customers there, selected customers, reduced the amount of lending we do to them, certainly done more PCMs, and the mix of the business is stronger. As rates go down, you'll probably see some revenue degradation there, but you'll also, we're winning mandates every day. We're trying to make that up with volume. And also, as this velocity of trade and PCM occurs, you get some benefit from that. So, and the mix of the business is significantly different. Where I think it's 55% of our revenue generation now in international is from our financial institutions area.
Yeah.
Much higher quality, much higher frequency of volume turnover. And therefore, and you know, you'll see some rate movements will hurt us. But the sustainability of the returns will be still there. Whether they stay at, I don't know if we didn't talk about what the ROE was externally. I'll get into trouble, so I won't be able to say that. But it was quite high. I think it'll come down a bit, but it won't go back to anywhere near what we saw it. And there's a couple of reasons for that. The mix of the business in the product sense, but and the customer segment sense. But we've taken an enormous amount of capital out of international, be it because of the lending and the risk-weighted asset reductions that we've had, but also, you know, we've repatriated $800 million of capital out of Thailand, returned it. We didn't need it. And we've done that, you know, clinically and surgically across a number of geographies. And we've also taken, I think, $600 million of costs out of the division in the last 5 or 6 years. Big chunk of that was international, because we've downsized and we've focused each country to have a particular role. They're all trying to be full service institutional businesses to a very small customer base, and then that's where the costs burgeoned. So it's much more surgical, it's more clinical, higher quality customer base, better product mix, lower capital usage, and a heavy focus on risk management and expense management. That's been it, and it's been disciplined all the way through. And Simon Ireland, who's actually, and that's maybe another session we should have with you guys, can take you through what's happened in this period of time. It's a very different international business. And it's networked now because we have the digital backbone being deployed, which means you have single technology that's being put out into each country that's integrated, which means better propositions. So it's a combination of all those factors. Rates will move up and down, volatility in markets affects us in that part of the business a lot because, you know, the VIX is down at 13%. You know, when SBB hit, it was up around 28%. Mm. That floats around. We've got a big financial markets local presence. But again, these things will swing and come around. But do I think that the returns are going to be sustainable through the cycle going forward? Yes, I do.
John, we'll have a look for obviously not just for you, but for the group. When we do the results, let's have a look at whether we can perhaps give you a little bit more granularity around, you know, volume rates, etc. I also will need to check whether we'll have some market stuff in there, I'm assuming.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We'll bring that back to the group.
But it is, the international network was not an asset. It was a drag, and we called it a network. It wasn't a bloody... Don't laugh, John. I know you've been telling us for years, but all of you have.
I
agree, right? But I don't think that's the case today. Yeah. It's not the case today. And going forward, I think it's an asset that we'll leverage much more.
Yeah. But I understand the question of sensitivity to rates. That makes sense. Azib, yeah. I'm so sorry because I've kept ignoring you. You're owed an opportunity. It's go okay. for it. But we do need to, we'll probably take one more after this and then we really do need to wrap up so I can show you some other things.
Thanks very much. So Mark, you've now got a division that's delivering an ROE in the mid-teens. I understood from your opening...
John said I wouldn't, by the way. You remember that?
Oh, stop.
Thank you. I just wanted to bring that. I've got to get one back eventually.
This is when he goes and writes a paper that...
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah, you keep it there. I get that too.
I understood from your opening comments that you're saying you'll try to optimise the product mix to try to increase the ROE.
Yep.
How high do you think the ROE can go? As you optimise the product mix, can we expect the revenue mix to be more skewed to transaction banking? Mm-hmm. And can you please shed some light on the extent of revenue synergies between the PCM sub-business and the market sub-business?
That's a tricky one.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I think they're connected, but not so... A lot of what we do in markets gets delivered through...
That might be something we need to come back to in the results.
Look, if you... Maybe the best way to answer this would be, if you look back in 2015, 2016, we were making about 45% of our... I'll get the numbers a little wrong so we can follow. About 45% coming through from the sort of loan product. And it would have been about 22% from payments cash management, I would have thought.
Yep.
I want that reversed. And we're on that journey. We're about a third now between payments or transaction banking, a third into markets and a third into corporate finance. By the way, when I say that too, remember in corporate finance, we've lifted the return on standalone lending. We've got very heavy disciplines in there on pricing since now. So that had to lift its game, but we still want less of it ultimately in the mix. So going forward, I'd rather, you know, some, and I know you'll probably get a little uncomfortable with this, Lisa. I'd like to see 40.
I didn't plan to call it, just saying.
40% plus coming from PCM would be my ideal. And then markets say, I don't know, 30% and trade and loans, the making up the balance. So, you know, that would be 25%. If you can get to that mix, I think you've got one more sustainable business and you've got a return on equity that is going to be sustainable in that mid-teens or above, depending on what's happening with rates, to the question that was asked before, because that will affect it a bit. We always manage, we know, because you don't like us doing markets business, John, and that's what, and so, but it's a fundamental customer proposition, so you have to run it well, right, and I get that. We resource it to a $2 billion, but I'd like to still see that move up by the stairwell, but I'd like to see this business up by the escalator, if you like, if I can use those analogies, because with markets, you don't want to grow too quickly because you can open yourself up to all sorts of risk that you don't want, and our markets business is heavily oriented to the customer, and so where we're investing in markets will be to financial institutions, customers particularly, securities, licenses, capital light, and we've got very strong and deep relationships because of these relationships we're building through PCM, to be frank. So I'd like to see more of that business. Markets, you know, $2 billion might oscillate around them, but I want it, the $2 billion, to go to 2.1, but I don't want that to being done overnight, because that's when you open up to too much risk. Whereas this business, we've got a different type of risk, which is more the risk that you asked us about earlier, But the volume and scale business you can get out of that is really strong, and it's much higher return on equity. Yeah. Whereas markets are still lower than ACM.
So last one, and then for anybody, apologies.
I'll be hanging around.
If I've missed you, we'll make sure to come back to you to make sure the question gets answered.
Thank you. You clearly built a very strong network, spine for the business across 10 countries, for $1.2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
You've still got to roll it out to the remaining 17 over the next 2 years. What's the cost to do that? Or given the technology has been built with these single systems that it can be rolled out to new jurisdictions, is it mostly just integrating? Like, can you give us any guidance about how much more it's going to cost to finish it?
Yeah, one of the things we did was in the division is we sort of capped our investment spend because it made you focus. And as we were dismantling a lot of the rubbish in the business, we targeted the investment spend to where we wanted to grow, PCM and markets predominantly. We also needed a loan system that was global. So that's why we put some money into that, because we needed to manage that risk better. And we've deployed to 10 countries now, the backbone. We've got another, we say 29 countries up there. We're not going to deploy it to Samoa, right? That's not going to happen. But we have now built the muscle up on how you deploy, and we've done the big countries. So we will continue to do that so that we finalise the full network and get the benefit of that, but it won't be as costly as what we've had with the big countries getting out of the way. That's where the big dollars were spent. And look, the team are saying it's 2 years, I want it done in 18 months, only because I want to get to the next piece that comes off this, which is the automation agenda. I think coming out of that is going to be the next wave of productivity for the division.
Okay.